Welcome back to Pete's Grit. I'm Zach Hodges.
And I'm Al Shanklin.
And today we are exploring all things point-of-care ultrasound in the ICU.
Yes. We are so lucky to be talking with Dr. Thomas Conlon and Dr. Sarah Ginsberg. Dr. Conlon is a pediatric intensivist at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where he also serves as the Director of Pediatric Critical Care Ultrasound. His professional and research interests include the clinical and educational outcomes after diagnostic and procedural ultrasounds, as well as how to really implement POCUS in your institution. We are so impressed by what he's done and so excited to talk with him.
Yes, and we're also excited to welcome Dr. Sarah Ginsberg to the episode. Dr. Ginsberg is assistant professor of pediatrics at UT Southwestern in Dallas, where she's also an intensivist at Children's Medical Center. Her professional and research interests include clinical applications of POCUS in the pediatric ICU. She's very active both locally and nationally to improve POCUS skills for pediatric intensivists, including participating in the Pediatric Research Collaborative on Critical Ultrasound, a subgroup at Palisi.
Yes, it is so exciting to hear about the future of POCUS. Let's get right to the episode.
Welcome back to Pete's Grit. We are so excited today to have Dr. Thomas Conlon and Dr. Sarah Ginsberg join us for this very important discussion. Welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
To get things started, will each of you tell us something about yourself and include something you enjoy outside of medicine?
You know, I'll start. I work at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. I'm an attending physician here, and I've been here on faculty since about 2013. I did my fellowship training here. I did combined internal medicine training out in Pittsburgh for residency. Something about myself outside of here, I was talking actually to Sarah last night, kind of preparing for this, and I'm really just a glorified Uber driver for my children right now, so that they are running around ragged, doing lots of different things. So my interest is in the 7 to 11-year-old population conversations and really sort of going into what their world looks like. They're much more capable of handling disagreements than we are as adults. The last conversation was about spaghetti and meatballs, how one kid really liked it and the other kid said, "Oh, that sucks." And then the other kid said, "Yeah, that's right, it does suck." And they moved on to the next topic. So So that's where I'm at in my life. And ultrasound is my jam.
That's amazing. How about you, Sarah?
Thanks, Zach. I am from Dallas, Texas, and am now back here in Dallas at UT Southwestern. I am also an ICU attending and have been here since 2019. Prior to that, I learned all about ultrasound from Dr. Conlon and was at CHOP for residency and fellowship, and that's where I discovered my interest in POCUS. Something about me that I enjoy outside of the ICU, I'm a huge sports fan, and I'm going to rub it in for everyone else. And hopefully this ages well whenever people are listening to it, but I'm very excited about the Texas Rangers making the World Series. And at least one team here is succeeding when the Cowboys will ultimately fail.
Nice.
This won't age very well, but Philadelphia just lost last night in a game 7. But the one thing that we can agree on is that we're at least both happy that Houston didn't win. So go Rangers.
That is for sure.
All right. How did each of you become interested in POCUS, and what are you working on related to POCUS today?
So my interest actually came out of the MedPeds experience. Internal medicine pediatric residency is 4 years long and crosses over between obviously pediatrics and internal medicine. I was very interested in ICU medicine on the adult side, but really liked sort of the pediatric population. And so it was a natural bridge. But during one of my rotations in my fourth year of residency was called a code elective, where you basically chase down all the adult codes that happen in the hospital. And even though it sounds like it would be a really exciting thing, there just aren't that many codes every single day. And so I ended up getting together with one of the ICU fellows, and this person was sort of a early adopter of bedside ultrasound. So we just went around scanning people. In that era, you know, we were really basing our management on Manny Rivers' early goal-directed therapy stuff, and it just changed my entire way of looking at hemodynamics and thinking about, as I was going into a pediatric ICU fellowship, what that meant for my academic career, but more importantly for my clinical career, being able to visualize the heart in a clinical setting, to being able to look at an inferior vena cava and think about volume in a totally different way than just central venous pressure or other types of things. That was just sort of handed down to me over the years. That really got me interested. I also really love the technical side of critical care and doing procedures. And so the overlap with ultrasound and both diagnostic and procedural stuff really, really stuck with me.
How about you, Sarah?
So I'll build on kind of what Thomas is talking about and give him some props. So Thomas is one of the very early adopters in pediatric critical care. When you think about POCUS and some of the OGs in the field, Thomas is one of them. And I was very fortunate to have benefited from his work because he and Dr. Akira Nishisaki had established a really comprehensive POCUS training program for fellowship by the time that I started fellowship in 2016. And so I'd say I entered fellowship pretty undifferentiated in terms of what my interests were. I had done clinical research and kind of figured I'd just end up doing some sort of clinical research project like most do. But then as I was looking around and meeting with different attendings, I found kind of the POCUS group. And I think what really interested me is I enjoy having my hands in a lot of different things, education, some kind of structural policy work, and also research. And I thought that POCUS really combined all of those things where you get to teach, you get to do clinical assessments, you get to work with multidisciplinary teams and how to incorporate POCUS and hospital-wide committees. And so that was really what drew me to POCUS, is that I had this opportunity to do all the things that interested me. And moving forward, that's kind of what I'm continuing to do here is develop a fellow curriculum, work on hospital committees on how to implement, do some research on the side, but that's kind of not my big thing. It's more kind of the dissemination and the structure behind it. And so I really like the ability to adapt to a lot of different interests in medicine.
You know, one thing that we almost highlight every week when we record is how important those early experiences are and early mentorship. And it seems like that was the case for each of you. So maybe just a plug for our trainees to get plugged in with great mentors and be active and do things early on so you might find what your eventual dream is.
Yeah. And I always tell the fellow applicants that I'm interviewing that when I was in their shoes, I didn't even know POCUS existed. And so I think having an open mind as well as your first year going in and looking at every possibility.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe as a means of a final introductory question before we jump into our topic, any relevant conflicts of interest to disclose?
I do not.
Nope.
Nice.
Sounds great. Alice, jump in with the case here.
All right. So you're taking care of a 3-year-old boy with BALL in the induction phase of chemotherapy. He's admitted to the PICU from the ONC floor with concern for ongoing shock. Your admission exam is notable for fever, tachycardia, hypotension, poor peripheral perfusion. Labs are notable for neutropenia and thrombocytopenia. A blood culture is obtained, broad spectrum antibiotics are provided, and fluid resuscitation is ongoing. You get your vasoactives to the bedside. One of the critical care fellows runs over, ready to put a probe on the chest. So this is really the core scenario we're looking at here. But before we dive into this case, what exactly is point-of-care ultrasound? What are we trying to accomplish with this?
Yeah, so that's a great start because there is no firm and fast definition that's out there that's really great about what point-of-care ultrasound is. To me, point-of-care ultrasound has four general components. It has that first, the thing that you're trying to look at is amenable to ultrasound interrogation, right? So ultrasound waves and the physics of the machine itself can actually answer the question that you have. And the second thing is that it has kind of simplified outcomes, right? Whether they're dichotomous or they're discrete qualitative outcomes, yes, no, present, absent, mild, moderate, or severe, is starting to bridge into some of the quantitative things, but really at its core, it is a rapid assessment that you can employ at the bedside that should have something that's got a simple answer to it. It should incorporate something that you see frequently or that is life-saving, meaning that I don't necessarily see pulmonary embolism on a day-to-day basis, but my point-of-care ultrasound should give me some information that tells me that this life-threatening condition that is treatable with a very specific targeted therapy has these certain findings that go along with it. But the case that you just presented is something that we face on a day-to-day basis as a critical care physician. And so it's valuable to overlie POCUS applications in things that we will get recurrent experiences with. And then the final thing is that we want it to have a steep learning curve, meaning that we can teach how to do it in a relatively short period of time and get trainees to be able to perform it effectively after that short period of training. So things that are going to take months or years for you to learn how to do really aren't going to help you in that day-to-day setting within the context of your training. And all of those sort of guiding principles, we try to overlay in the other disciplines as well, right? So we have within pediatric critical care, what I think is a set of, you know, things that we should look for and questions that we should be able to answer. But now that we have point of care ultrasound that's evolving into neonatology, into pediatric anesthesia, into general pediatrics, people have to think about kind of what applications they're looking to do because they encounter different things over the periods of time. And so that's sort of the fun of point of care ultrasound is that it's really evolving. I think one of the things also to think about, you know, it's what is point of care ultrasound is the question of what is not point of care ultrasound. And I really try to stand back from that question a little bit. We know that for a period of time, lots of people thought that lung ultrasound was impossible. Right? Because air does not transmit ultrasound waves. And so you're not going to get anything for putting a probe on the chest. And then you know what somebody did? They put a probe on the chest and they figured out, wow, like I can actually see something. I can figure something out from what I'm doing here. And so saying that there is, oh, we definitely can't do that, that just limits us from thinking about new applications that may be relevant for us. We also are finding that maybe qualitative assessments are going to be relevant in what we do, and they might be actually different from what radiologists or cardiologists look at. And the one thing that I will say that we need to be really careful about is the congenital disease population, congenital cardiac patients. The American Society of Echocardiography just came out with a statement talking about point-of-care ultrasound and a lot of other sort of national and international guidelines tell us that obviously anatomic descriptors that are coming from point-of-care ultrasound technology probably are not sufficient, and our level of training and experience with looking at cardiac anatomy is not sufficient. So if there is any question about cardiac anomalies or congenital disease, that is fully within the wheelhouse of cardiology. It goes to a point that we're going to be discussing, I'm sure, throughout this, that you know, collaboration and talking between groups and being able to translate relevant findings is important.
You brought up a lot of great points. Just to reinforce, make sure I have this correctly. So point of care ultrasound is something that you use to diagnose things that you see frequently or those high risk scenarios where an intervention could potentially be life-saving. And you also want it to be teachable and easily repeatable. But in general, is it fair to say that with point of care ultrasound, we're trying to answer for the most part, yes or no questions. And there are limitations when you think about it. It's not exactly a comprehensive diagnostic study, especially in that congenital heart disease population.
Yeah, I think that that's a very good way of thinking about it. And again, when you put a probe on your chest, it's just like when you put a stethoscope on the chest, right? Now, you can put a stethoscope on every chest that you look at. And we talk about this in rounds every day, right? You need to have purpose to what you're doing. And your purpose comes from a question that you're asking. What are you actually following on that patient? What is the question that you're asking? And can that ultrasound actually answer that, right? I do like to say, you know, yes, no type of stuff, but we do know that medicine is far more nuanced than yes and no. And so evolving from that and putting these kind of simplified answers into these complex clinical situations needs to have a platform of a question that you're trying to answer and putting lots of different things together to get what your answer is.
Yes. Maybe thinking about our clinical case here, the patient in likely septic shock, what advantages does POCUS add to a bedside clinician's physical exam and lab assessment of a patient dealing in shock?
I think it's a window inside, and that's important because, you know, traditionally when we think about shock, there's been so much, especially in pediatrics, about this distinction between warm shock and cold shock. So warm shock, this vasodilatory, low SVR setting that often is implied to have normal cardiac contractility, whereas cold shock has, you know, clamp down, high SVR, potential myocardial dysfunction, and that you might tailor your choice of ionotrope or vasopressor based on warm shock or cold shock. There's a lot of guidelines there. I think the problem is that we as clinicians are not good at physical exam informing whether the patient is actually in warm shock or cold shock. And Thomas's group, led by a paper from Sarah Walker, they looked at patients that were called septic shock. What was their distinction of cold versus warm? It was in a clinical pathway. And then what did the cap refill, pulse pressure, extremity exam, all of those things that we actually look at to say cold versus warm, were they actually concordant? And some were and some weren't. And I think kind of the overall takeaway point from this paper was that A, it's hard to figure out just based on physical exam, and B, then when they looked at ionotropes, it was the mismatch group. So if cold shock, but actually needing something that's potentially vasodilated, actually did not worse and potentially better than the actual aligned group. And this was without using ultrasound. And so that means that we're getting it wrong. And again, generally a whole we, as myself included, if we just do it based on vital signs and physical exam. So then what additional information can we get? We can take a quick look inside with cardiac POCUS, and then additional supplementation of lung or abdomen, depending on what the scenario is, which I think we'll get into later. And I think one of the reasons why there's a lot of different literature about the discordance is that sepsis-induced myocardial dysfunction is so present, way more than we appreciate, and is an evolving picture. You can have a normal echo on admission that can change 6 hours later. And so I think a lot of these kids that we classically are defining as air quotes warm shock actually are having an element of myocardial dysfunction and might actually benefit from less SVR than what we're doing. And conversely, patients that are in air quote cold shock that we say, oh, they should have myocardial dysfunction, they shouldn't need fluid, they might need fluid. And if you can show based on their volume status with the limitations that ultrasound has for volume status, as well as normal contractility, fluid might benefit these patients. And so I think it's not easy to classify shock based on just kind of the external factors. So taking a look inside can be a real benefit, because I think we're learning as we look more that things are way more complex than kind of we initially gave them credit for.
Oh, thank you. That's really powerful to hear the literature of my cold feet versus warm feet distinction is not going to improve outcomes if I use that as my norepi versus epi choice.
And I'll dork out for a second here, but like I'm talking to a critical care audience, so we're all kind of the same people. The thing that got me so interested in critical care medicine was a patient's fluid status, right? On the adult side of medicine, a simple thing, like what is my patient's intravascular volume status? And we have gone through hundreds of years of medicine and we still don't have a great way of figuring that key point out. Instead, we have an algorithm that says you slam them with 60 per kilo of fluid right up front and you kind of go from there. And there's got to be a more elegant way of looking at that. And I'm not even going to proclaim that ultrasound is the absolute answer to that. But thinking beyond just a central venous pressure, thinking beyond, you know, a plastic stethoscope that's sitting at the bedside of all of our critically ill patients is something that's important. And we do actually think, I believe, in more complex ways. And I think that the study that Sarah sort of alluded to, Sarah's, I think, great manuscript, which I was very happy when she invited me to be part of it, you know, really tells us that we define cold and warm shock and we treat based upon something that may not be captured by the flick of a capillary bed. It might not be captured by, you know, a pulse pressure difference, but we're doing something for these kids and our outcomes are actually pretty good. And when you stand in front of, you know, even a group of residents and you present the patient that you did earlier, that patient is coming in with shock, what do you do? And you give them options, right? You start norepi, do you start epi, or do you give them fluids, right? And if you're standing in front of people, and this is part of your case conference, right? What does everybody do when you present this case? Everybody stays silent for a couple minutes because they're looking around because there's got to be a catch, right? Because you wouldn't be presenting this case unless there was a catch. There was something interesting about it. And so then you go to the residents and they sort of shyly raise their hand, say, okay, what would you do? And they will say, I'm going to give them 5 per kilo, and then I'm going to feel that liver edge, and I'm going to listen for crackles just to make sure that I'm not over-treating myocarditis in this patient, because that's what you're trying to get me to do. You're trying to get me to fluid overload this patient. That's not a great way of doing this, right? So, you know, these basic things, when you see an inferior vena cava, like you look at a child and they're cold, but they've been outside of blankets or outside of warmers, and you're not exactly sure. And you look at an inferior vena cava that's completely collapsed, and you look at a heart that's just sort of slamming against itself. oh, like they already got 60 per kilo of volume. They need more than that. And they're going to tolerate that. And that's like a basic sort of finding that is pretty powerful in my sort of my world, beyond just sort of the clinical exam.
I think what we're getting at is our patients in the pediatric ICU are so complex, and one physical exam finding might be not consistent with the actual physiology, and having another adjunctive way to get more information about our patient can be helpful. And also for our learners, sometimes I feel like blood pressure is equated with oxygen delivery, and it certainly is not that. And if you have a physiology that actually needs less afterload and more forward flow, perhaps ultrasound can give us that answer. Maybe to take the bottom line somewhat up front, do we have any evidence that POCUS, maybe assessment of patients like this in shock, improves outcomes?
So we do, kind of. And you got to sort of stretch yourself a little bit. And I kind of actually want to sort of take a step back to kind of the 10,000 foot view. Because I do think that not all places, and you know, we're tailoring kind of our conversation to sort of a trainee level of, not all places are doing ultrasound. I actually hear about places that are not doing vascular access using ultrasound. And so sort of jumping into the world of, you know, shock and sort of hemodynamic assessment is actually maybe going beyond where people are even considering going. I think that point of care ultrasound, from a procedural standpoint, there is no doubt that it improves patient safety, that improves provider performance. And that is across the spectrum of any type of procedure that you are going to do. If you can see the needle tip going into the place where you want it to go, you will minimize the harm, because the needle tip causes the harm. Okay? So no matter what procedure, the data is robust in adults and pediatrics. And so I think that that question is pretty much answered. When we think about other diagnostic applications, okay, lung ultrasound, very simple type stuff, right? Is it a pleural effusion or not? That is a very easy thing to learn. And I've been earlier in my career told, you know, put a chest tube into this child that has unilateral opacification, right? When it's a consolidation and the chest tube would be going into a consolidated lung, right? So they're very simple things. There's a great manuscript by an Italian group about neonatal pneumothorax and lung ultrasound. And I think that learning how to diagnose pneumothorax is a little bit more complicated, but definitely doable and changes outcomes and management. From other diagnostic applications and sort of getting to your ultimate question about shock, what we know about ultrasound is that it adds new information. It changes our perception of what we think is going on, and it changes our management. Now, whether or not that translates into clinical outcomes is something that we are still kind of looking at. There is literature in the adult world that tells us that hemodynamic assessment and integration within care improves mortality, and it likely is due to the reduction of fluid overload in patients. Identifying patients who are non-fluid responders and therefore transitioning from fluid management to vasopressor or inotropin. We know in pediatrics in particular that we give about twice as much fluid per kilo of patient than adults do. And so we, in particular, are very vulnerable to the harm of fluid. Just like Sarah said earlier, we know that in retrospective studies, between 30 and 50% of patients who have septic shock have myocardial dysfunction with it. We know that post-cardiac arrest, patients have myocardial dysfunction that is associated with. What we don't know is whether or not our management to improve and support cardiac function actually means something as far as their ultimate outcome. Now, we do have good literature, physiologic literature from the old days of PA catheters, that tells us that normalization of things like cardiac index, wedge pressures, that sort of stuff, in pediatric critical care actually matters and improves patient outcomes. So if you kind of put that all together, we think that this data that tells us a little bit more physiologically about preload contractility and afterload and specific perturbations that are kind of unique, like pericardial effusion, like pneumothorax, like pulmonary embolism, kind of those rare things that we're like, oh, that's interesting. We can identify on this. So we believe that the outcomes are better. Now, this is with a little bit of a caveat, okay, and I'm kind of going off on a tangent here, but there are some things that we have to be really careful about. There is a recent paper from 2019 from a group in an emergency department, Mosier et al., that tried to do hemodynamic ultrasound in the emergency department prior to initiation of hemodynamic management. And they actually found an increase in their mortality. And they believe that this is due to delayed therapies being initiated in a patient who has shock. And I put that together with some data about doing like a fast exam, right? And not necessarily showing patient benefit from doing fast exams in pediatrics. That's a whole other conversation I don't need to get into. And I also put that with literature that tells us that people are really interested in putting ultrasound into CPR, right? Resuscitation, and sort of seeing the H's and T's in real time as people are doing compressions, but recognizing that when you put a probe on the chest, it takes time. And so the time away from compressions is greatly increased when you put ultrasound probe on the chest. You know, in our institution, and likely in your guys' institution, you know, your time off the chest is probably nowadays between 3 and 5 seconds, right? It's no longer like, let's just wait for the whole 10 seconds. No, we know that compressions is what's needed. And so when you have time-dependent management decisions, getting an ultrasound may not be exactly the right thing to do unless you are working in a system that allows it to be done quickly and have a process to deliver the therapies in a timely manner. And so I think that that's the kind of caveat that I give to outcomes, is that you actually need to understand the setting that you're working in. And again, the context more than just does ultrasound help or hurt. And so I believe that once you get that patient stable and you're asking those sorts of questions and you've already initiated therapies, that ultrasound is wildly beneficial to patient populations. Now, the other thing to go off onto another tangent is that it's really hard for us to get data about outcomes, particularly in pediatrics and particularly in pediatric shock. And I would think that in my sort of practice setting, which is a little bit of a larger, you know, pediatric critical care department, that I got a lot of patients that are around that I can look at these sorts of answers. If I were to go to my faculty group and say, I am interested in doing a study where I compare integration of ultrasound with no integration of ultrasound in the management of shock, our group would say that there is no equipoise, that ultrasound is actually for us now a component of the clinical exam for our patients. And it is not fair to patients to not be able to look at their heart, to not be looking. Now, different places are at different spots in what they're doing and how they've progressed in training and how they've integrated it into clinical practice. But at some point in time, when you are able to see into the body, just like what Sarah said, it's influential in what you do. And figuring out a way to actually measure it and to compare it to sort of the older, quote, standards is going to be a challenge moving forward. And I'm not sure we got to really think as a community how we're going to try to do that.
Oh, absolutely. I especially appreciate the idea that you are not waiting. You are not walking away from the bedside. You're responding and people are going to look. This is the way of the future. Now, Sarah and Thomas, I'd like to put you in the position where I'm your first year fellow. I bring down this 3-year-old with leukemia and sepsis to the unit. Maybe he's gotten a bolus on the floor. We're giving more fluid. His MAP's in the 50s. We are not delaying vasoactives. We get an ultrasound to the bedside quickly. What specifically in this patient am I looking for? And what would I see that would point me towards more fluid? What would I see that would point me towards epi or norepi specifically?
So I think, Alice, you're hinting at basics of a hemodynamic assessment for diagnostic ultrasound. And we'll start with that. I'll say from a bigger picture perspective, there are about as billion different adult protocols for using POCUS in shock. And that usually incorporates, again, because pattern-wise, things that make adults sick, it incorporates the hemodynamics, but also incorporates the chest and often involves the abdomen as well, because adults have a lot more abdominal pathologies. In pediatrics, unless we have a clue into the chest or the abdomen, I think we really focus on the going back to just the core hemodynamics and air quotes, you know, we use hemodynamics, but kind of fluid function check. And so starting with volume status, you know, the question is the patient fluid responsive? Would they benefit from additional fluid? the traditional teaching is looking at the IVC and its ability to have respiratory variation. You'll hear a lot about IVC collapsibility, but it's either collapsibility or distensibility, depending on the type of ventilation that the patient's under. So for negative pressure ventilation, natural airway breathing, this patient that you've just scooped from the floor, assuming you're not bagging him, we're looking at IVC collapsibility and respiratory variation. And how basically the preload is changing with inspiration and expiration. And so you can kind of trend that dynamically over time. And if you're seeing basically greater than 50% collapsibility, or you don't have to measure it, you can really just eyeball if you're seeing significant collapsibility IVC, that's a good indication that the patient would benefit from additional fluid. I think the problem is that the IVC is really influenced by pressures in the abdomen, pressures in the chest, and it gets really much more complicated the more organ systems are involved. So a ventilated patient, patient with an abdominal catastrophe, a patient with high mean airway pressures, all that can influence the IVC. So in a pure hypovolemic state, the IVC is a great evaluation. As the patient gets sicker, it gets more complicated, but it's one of the better basic level introductions that we have to volume responsiveness. There are more advanced calculations, especially looking at flow across the aortic valve, but that is not a POCUS level that we would expect essentially a first year fellow, unless they've had previous cardiac training to obtain. So really for, can I give more volume? We're looking at the IVC. When we think about function, again, building on what Thomas talked about, we're not necessarily looking for an EF or a shortening fraction, although the shortening fraction can be done, again, with more advanced calculations. You're looking for a global gestalt. Yes, no. Do I change things? Do I call cardiology immediately? Do I call cardiology saying, I'd like you to come down, or do I call cardiology saying, you need to run? That's kind of how I think of it. It helps you triage what's going on. And so when we look at LV and RV function, we're looking at abnormal or normal, and then mild, moderate, or severe. In terms of dysfunction, I think really the things that would change your management, change your ionotropy, would be moderate to severe. If you see mild, it's good to note, but that's really not going to, I think, immediately change how you're managing the patient. And so we're looking at, admittedly, LV is easier to see than RV, but trying to get a global assessment of both. Do we see dysfunction or do we not? And if we see dysfunction, are we worried that it's moderate to severe? And then lastly, building on the RV, you're looking at relative ventricular size. Is there evidence of RV dilation or elevated right-sided pressures that might influence your resuscitation? Where again, we're not trying to measure a tricuspid regurgitant fraction. We're just kind of looking at some pattern recognition that can help you understand what's going on in terms of relative pressures. And so that really gets, we've talked about hypovolemic shock or kind of shock state. We've talked about cardiogenic shock or cardiac dysfunction. Oftentimes, sepsis is kind of a mixture of a lot of these things. And then you can also look for obstructive shock. And so you can see pretty easily, is there a large pericardial effusion? And are we starting to see some evidence of echo tamponade? Again, tamponade is a clinical diagnosis, but is there echo evidence to support that? So all of those things can be done in a hemodynamic screening that Thomas would always teach us. Once you're doing well with, or once you're comfortable with ultrasound, it should take you less than 5 minutes. And so you can answer all of those questions, and then you can add in additional lung scans or abdominal scans if you have a clinical concern. And then I think the added benefit of POCUS is its repeatability. As we talked about, sepsis-induced myocardial dysfunction can evolve over time. A pericardial effusion can evolve over time. And so I do think, you know, we're often quick to get cardiology involved, especially if this is an oncology patient who's potentially been anthracycline exposed. But we can't necessarily put all our eggs in the basket of a normal echo within an hour of admission or a normal echo within the first day of admission. If they're clinically changing, you need to see what's going on inside, again, essentially, because you might have a normal echo and be treating what you think of as a low SVR state, and then you evolve into myocardial dysfunction. And if you're still acting on essentially old information, then you can put the, not necessarily maximize the benefit to the patient. I'd say the one downside of ultrasound and hemodynamic assessment is that it cannot directly address SVR. Basic ultrasound, basic POCUS cannot look at SVR, similar to kind of we talked about clinical exam findings. I think the difference is that if you can rule out all the other types of shock, you can potentially say, well, I know it's not cardiac. I know it's not obstructive. I think they're reasonably volume resuscitated, or they're in a volume responsive physiology, then use it as additional evidence to point to a low SVR state based on everything else you're putting together. You know, POCUS isn't going to decide things for you in isolation, but it can be a really helpful kind of additional tool.
That was a great and detailed answer. Let me summarize a bit and feel free to give me feedback if I get something wrong. So for assessment of hypovolemia, you're looking mostly at the IVC collapsibility and that patient who's spontaneously breathing, who doesn't have multi-organ dysfunction or significant abdominal or thoracic pathology, if it's collapsing more than 50%, that would usually suggest they're hypovolemic and needed more volume. Maybe the next level up would be looking at flow across aortic valve, but we'll save that for another discussion. The next function assessment, mild, moderate versus severe. Is there really any type of thing you can share with us to help us infer what mild dysfunction or moderate dysfunction looks like? Or is it just something that you get a grasp of over time?
It's a little bit of both. When I teach, similar to Thomas, I've adapted a lot of his lectures to teach residents and trainees. And part of it is you need to see it to know it. And one of the ways that I encourage residents, especially because residents aren't going to have access to repeated POCUS teaching, but even the fellows as well, is your patients are going to be getting echoes. And so while you're learning POCUS, you have this expert images and expert read. The echoes, assuming a structurally normal heart, I'm not going to even, again, like Thomas said, try to interpret something with a hypoplast unless it's a decompensating, like large pericardial effusion or something like that. But it's structurally four chambers. Start looking at those echoes, because if the read says normal, then of those million different views, there's going to be the five basic views that we teach in POCUS. And so you can start looking at that saying that's normal. And when the read says abnormal, then you start getting that information and kind of getting that idea. And so you can use the data that's already present, because I think a lot of it is pattern recognition. There are ways to evaluate. Really, what you're looking at when you look at squeeze is how are the walls coming together and how is the myocardium thickening? Those are two global evaluations that you can use in any view. There are a couple other view-specific tidbits, but especially in the parasternal long, which is a great LV view. But I think those, the walls coming together and the thickening, is kind of a global assessment that you can do. But to say what is normal actually look like, you need to have someone tell you this is normal. And so whether that comes from your cardiologist, there are image banks on the internet. And then as your local POCUS programs develop, you'll get to have image review within your division for QA and QI. And so it's a combination of everything, but it is generally not measuring a number like you do for a formal cardiology echo. We're not saying measure the shortening fraction and say, oh, if it's less than, you know, X, then it's this type of dysfunction. It is starting to pattern recognize, but there are many ways that you can go about starting the pattern recognition.
Oh, thank you.
Just to add on to that, that was exquisitely stated, Sarah. The other thing that I really like about POCUS is that it makes you look at pictures in a different way, and not just your pictures, but the pictures from the cardiologist, right? So I remember as a trainee, right, you'd get a formal echo, and on rounds the next day, you would say, you know, the echo showed mild dysfunction. The echo was normal. The echo was, and you kind of looked at the pictures, but, you know, the pictures for formal echo are like, they're like 80 of them, and they've got a bunch of color splattered all over them, and you don't actually know what they're looking at. And even now, you know, I get an interpretation of an echo that is normal from the cardiology team, and normal is defined as a shortening fraction of 28%, a fractional shortening of 28% here. So you've got a kid with a fractional shortening of, let's say, 29 to 30% that is just defined as normal. And you look at the picture, and now you're kind of putting together a number with what's actually inside your patient's body, and you've got a kid that's in shock that has normal cardiac functioning, but you look at it and you're like, that's not normal for what his physiology should be, right? And so I find myself, as I was sort of learning how to do this stuff, I found myself actually diving back into some of those pictures that they were taking on my patients and looking for myself and sort of saying, yeah, would I call that normal? Like in this clinical context, is this mild? Oh, they call this moderate. That looks pretty severe to me. Like moderate is a problem that you're going to be. So the other thing that it does is that now that I'm diving into those pictures, I'm actually able to communicate with my cardiologist in a different way now as well, because I've actually looked at what they've done. I've actually looked at the numbers and I've kind of put those pieces together and I've said, well, how did you get to this, right? There's a pericardial effusion, but the IVC doesn't look big. So that tells me that it's probably not under pressure. Is that, am I getting that right? And so having these types of conversations, rather than just kind of looking into our medical record and saying, oh, like the cardiologist called this normal and talking about it on rounds and saying, just kind of walking past that, It's just sort of another aspect. So use what you have around you to learn what normal and abnormal is, and then overlay it with your patient and what they actually look like.
Oh, I appreciate that, because something that gave me pause about POCUS for LV function initially is hearing from my cards fellow friends, you know, we discussed this. We're not sure about the function. It's really difficult to determine. And so I like putting yourself into that conversation and be like, yes, the shortening fraction is 28%. And he's generating a map of 47. You know, like, how is this normal? So,
right. You know, cardiologists are people too. And we kind of sort of live in our silos. When you actually talk to them, you realize that there's disagreement between them about what function is. And there's actually literature out there telling us that there's disagreement about stuff, whether you quantify it, whether you qualify it. And the ability for us in particular to take these images and have the patient in front of us, rather than having people say, oh, I'm going to get an echo on this patient in 24 hours. Oh, I'll get it in 48 hours. And then 12 hours later, you're going to get your intervention. No, like, I'm actually doing stuff hemodynamically to this patient in real time, and I'm actually able to see it. So my communications are actually more effective for them as well in trying to figure out what they're supposed to answer for us, what we're missing that they can include. And, you know, this gets to sort of some other types of stuff, but, you know, now we have a system. In the old days, we didn't have a way for our cardiologists to see our images with point of care ultrasound. And we'd say, hey, we've got a patient up here that has cardiac dysfunction, like bad cardiac dysfunction. And they would say, you know, you get the fellow on the phone, they'd say, no, you can't really pick up anything on those point of care ultrasound machines. We'll get. Now we have the opportunity to upload these images into the medical record.
Really?
So that we can say, hey, like, can you just take a look at this? This ain't right. And they'll look and they'll say, yeah, that definitely isn't right. We need to get up there and sort of do a little something about it. Or like, yeah, your images are way sufficient for figuring out what, you know, you need to do. So let us know if you've got a question. We'll come by with a formal echocardiogram tomorrow. If your only question is contractility, like, you got it. Let's figure out sort of follow-up stuff and get some more formal imaging in a little bit. So the ability to communicate with others, we get this great fear about that we're treading in waters of other people and that they're going to be angry with us and that they're going to, no, like, all of us are trying to do the same thing, which is provide good care to kids and trying to improve their outcomes. So it's been really beneficial for us.
I think something that we all recognize is just how dynamic these patients are early on in their critical illness. You know, they come up to us looking awful, poor perfusion. We put some volume in, they don't get much better. We get our POCUS, we get our image, and then, you know, we start titrating vasoactive. Oh gosh, they've been intubated now. You know, things change over time. And having that ability to get a picture, reassess after your intervention is really important for us. And thank you for listening to this episode of Pete's Crit. Please remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as replacement for medical advice. The views expressed during this episode by hosts and our guests are their own and do not reflect the official position of their institutions. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can email us at pedscritpodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter @critpeds and @pedscrit on Instagram for real-time show updates. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review in your favorite podcasting application and share with your colleagues. Also, if you'd like to support the making of the podcast, please see the description for Venmo information and how to become a Patreon. Any donation will be appreciated. Thank you again for listening, and goodbye.